This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It is a pleasure to have this opportunity to fill you all in on how the sociology program at UCSF works to make the invisible visible in service of population health and health equity. And the main event tonight is three of our distinguished recent program alums will be sharing their dissertation research with you. But first, I'd like to briefly set the stage by introducing you all to the discipline of sociology more broadly and what it adds to the UCSF campus. One of sociology's founders used a metaphor of invisible strings to describe the many unwritten, unspoken rules that govern human behavior. And sociology as a discipline helps to reveal these invisible strings, to reveal what's hidden. Sociology as a discipline helps to reveal how the world around us, our neighborhoods, our schools, our families, our social groups, all shape our life chances, our decisions, our behaviors, and our preferences in fundamental ways that we're often not even fully aware of. The sociology program at UCSF has a rich tradition of making the invisible visible in our healthcare systems, in our research labs, and in our communities to shed light on the many hidden influences on population health. The sociology program was founded 55 years ago, back in 1968. It was the very first sociology doctoral program in the country to specialize in medical sociology. Our sociology PhD students receive rigorous training in quantitative and qualitative research methods, in sociological theory, and health policy. Many of our students engage in intensive field research and original data collection as part of their dissertation work. Today, we will hear from three program alums who have completed their doctoral studies in sociology. Their work demonstrates the power of sociological research for revealing what is hidden in the scientific and social systems that produce medicines, deliver healthcare, and spur medical innovation. They'll each present for about 15 minutes, followed by brief closing remarks from my colleague, sociology faculty member, Stacy Torres. And then we should have plenty of time at the end for your questions. Our first presenter will be Dr. Nicole Foti, who defended her dissertation just last month. Nicole's dissertation research was supported by UCSF's Graduate Dean's Dissertation Completion Fellowship, and a fellowship from the Center for Engaged Scholarship. Nicole will be continuing her research as a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins next year. I am especially grateful that Nicole was willing to join us because she is on the East Coast, where it's currently very late at night. Nicole will be sharing research from her dissertation titled Open Pharma, Collective Action to Open Pharma. She will be followed by Dr. Melanie Jeske. Dr. Jeske earned her PhD in sociology last year, so she's had a little bit more time to recover. She is joining us from the University of Chicago, where she is a postdoctoral researcher at the rank of instructor at the Institute on the Formation of Knowledge. Mel will be sharing her research from her dissertation titled Organs and Humans on Chips, Translation, Biomedical Models, and the Political Economy of Innovation. Finally, Jessica Harrison, who defended her dissertation just last month, will be presenting her research. Jessica, in addition to providing mental health care in her therapy practice, will be continuing her research as a postdoctoral research fellow with the Osher Center next year. And tonight, Jessica will be sharing her research from her dissertation titled Surveillance Medicine in Perinatal Care, Negotiating Constraints, Constructing Risk, and the Elusive Goal of Mental Health Integration. Following Jessica's presentation, we'll hear briefly from Dr. Stacy Torres. I am now pleased to turn things over to Dr. Nicole Foti.
Thank you so much, Kristen. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. So as Kristen just mentioned, I am going to present on my dissertation that I defended last month, and it is entitled Open Pharma Collective Action to Common Pharmaceutical Knowledge. So I first want to give a little bit of background on my research agenda, as well as some background on what I'll present today. My research lies at the intersection of pharmaceuticals, health equity, and the political economy of biomedicine. Many of us know that access to medicines is a global health issue. In 2020, the World Health Organization designated expanding access to medicines as one of the urgent health challenges for the next decade. Globally, an estimated one-third of people lack access to essential medicines. New drugs that are in the research pipeline disproportionately focus on treating diseases in wealthier countries over diseases that tend to impact the global poor. And in the United States, even medicines that have been around for decades, such as insulin, have seen major price increases, and that has led to rationing, hospitalizations, and numerous deaths. So my research agenda examines movements, as well as policies, institutional policies, state policies, that aim to reorganize biomedical innovation in the drug space in order to advance goals of health equity. So a key part of my dissertation focused on this small group called Open Insulin. They're a pretty unique initiative. They're founded in 2015 by a person with type 1 diabetes. It's a group of volunteers, mostly both citizen scientists, as well as more traditionally trained scientists. And their aim, that their goal back in 2015 and throughout, has been to create affordable insulin, but rooted in the community. So trying to create a mechanism or a model to produce insulin in a community-based setting. And so they were founded in this place called a community biology lab. And these are public wet lab spaces that people can come in and do biology research. And so I have a photo of where they originated in Oakland, California. And I'm going to talk just a little more about community biology labs in a moment. But importantly, this group that I focus on for part of my research, they were founded during a period where the price of insulin rose really significantly in the United States. So they're really reacting to what this graph shows around 2003. It shows up through 2016, but the price has increased continually after that. It shows a significant rise in the cost of insulin for diabetics and anyone who uses insulin. And what this graph shows is not only was there this major increase in the price, but these are four different types of insulin. They're the leading forms, both fast acting and slow acting. These are major types of insulin, and they rose all at the same time. So the companies that make these medicines, opted to increase their price simultaneously. And it really left patients with little option but to pay exorbitant prices for insulin. And so, this group, Open Insulin, is really reacting to this setting, this context or background. And so the Open Insulin Project thought we can use these community biology lab spaces, which have been increasing throughout the world over the past decade or so. And they allow for broader participation in biology research by allowing anyone from the public to join the lab and tinker or work on a project. And so the idea is that these spaces, these community biology spaces, as well as do-it-yourself biology, that these would help democratize science, or kind of open up science to more individuals, more actors, and not just leave, science to universities and to companies, but to get more people involved and to think about science in a different space and potentially in a different way. And we can actually view this community biology and this group, Open Insulin, in a broader phenomena that's happening called open science. Maybe some of you or most of you have heard about this. It's really been a growing trend over in recent years. Open science includes really an assortment of practices such as open access publishing, an open peer review process, and then more relevant for what I'll present on today is there's also an aspect of open science to share data and research tools in a more uninhibited way. So this includes agreements that might limit or bar patents on research more generally. And I'll talk more about how that's being implemented in the sites that I examine. So I'd say the kind of key part of open science is it's a really broad umbrella term, means a lot of different things to different people, but there's kind of this key element that it's a reaction to the privatization of science. So scientific knowledge and the products of science have been increasingly privatized, whether through intellectual property or kind of being shifted towards companies. And so this kind of open science movement is at least a major part of it is in reaction to that privatization. And we see here that in 2003, the U.S. Office of Science and Technology Policy named this year the year of open science. And so that's a kind of the point of departure for my research. I came to this dissertation and I asked, how is open science being applied to pharmaceuticals specifically and why? Pharmaceuticals are an area of biomedicine that are particularly entrenched in intellectual property regimes, usually patents. And so by studying this space, we can understand some of the key tensions for open science in biomedicine more broadly. And importantly, what are the implications for equity embedded in those efforts? So in addition to open insulin, I studied several other initiatives. This is not a comprehensive list, but just a few examples. So I examined some smaller groups of researchers that were based in university labs. That include the Open Source Malaria Project is a good example. And then there are some larger initiatives backed by millions of dollars also in universities that I studied. So one includes this, the Neuro, which is the Montreal Neurological Hospital at McGill University. And they are a fully open science institute, which is pretty novel based on research, but all of the efforts that I looked at. And then I also studied some nonprofit, non-academic organizations. So Open Source Drug Discovery up here, and then Open Source Pharma Foundation are another couple organizations. And then just quickly about my research methods. So I drew on three different types of data. So one aspect of my project was I did an ethnographic research, which means engaged in observations as well as qualitative data collection through interviews. So I spent about 300 hours observing open insulin, including their organizational activities and research activities. I also did in-depth interviews with open insulin members, as well as leaders and researchers in academic and nonprofit-based initiatives. So those initiatives that I just showed on that slide, I also interviewed leaders and researchers of those, as well as other initiatives that are applying open science into pharma research and development. And then finally, I had I did a content analysis. So I examined journal articles, I examined websites, as well as university and nonprofit organization policies, all with the element of, again, applying open science into the space of pharma. So for this rest of my presentation, I'm just going to give a pretty broad overview of my findings from my dissertation. And so what I did in my research was to map this open pharma movement. So these initiatives are relatively new, only in the past decade or so. Have they really been kind of budding and new initiatives emerging, new funding to organize them and new actors that are engaging in this space? So my research is effectively mapping this movement. And the first thing I wanted to do was go ahead and establish the why, right? Why are actors interested in applying open science to drug research and development and pharmaceuticals more generally? What motivates people working in this space? The why has bearing on how open pharma gets enacted in practice and to what ends, right? So I identified three major themes for motivating open pharma actors. One of the most prominent one was this idea of neglected diseases and areas of market failure. And so can we use open science to address these otherwise neglected disease areas? So some of these include disease areas where there's no pool of current users of a therapy. So, right. So like for future pandemics, that would be an example where there's limited pool of users, such as with rare medical conditions. Other neglected disease areas include like tropical diseases, as well as many disease types that tend to impact areas where there are higher poverty rates and countries in the global south. And so that was a major motivator for many open pharma initiatives and actors. They wanted to use open science to intervene on there. And then a second motivator was a declining innovation system. So scholars and others have noted that we've produced less novel therapeutics. We have, you know, the complexity with drug research is ever increasing, which creates larger costs. And so actors were really interested, can we use open science to revamp this innovation ecosystem and share our research more broadly? And then finally, actors also were focused on affordability and access to medicines. So that was a pretty key theme throughout. Can we use open science to increase affordability and access? And then my second, you know, broad theme that I focused on in my research was establishing the how, right? I was interested in how is open science being operationalized in pharma? How is it being built and organized? And so I studied policies for open sharing. And so many of these mandated no patents would be taken out. A lot of them mandated that they would share research in the public domain rather than waiting, say, for publications. And then that would also include negative findings, which is I won't go into, but it's also kind of an important piece that open science might help us with. The second was these micromobilization contexts. This is actually drawing from social movements literature, but these are basically just spaces where you can influence ideas or pass along ideas and others can take them up. And so they were establishing these spaces to basically catalyze further open science in pharma, right? Talking with others about the merits and the benefits of doing this. And then finally, I noted those initiatives that I studied and I map out some of the institutional infrastructure that's being built, right? These big university-based units or individual nonprofits, those kinds of things. And then finally, I also noted a number of barriers to establishing open science in pharma. One of them in universities was commercialization imperatives or policies. So a lot of universities have these policies that were artifact of a law, the Bayh-Dole Act, which tells universities that get federal funding that they need to try to commercialize their products, not often translates to patents. And so one barrier was these commercialization policies. Another was around publishing norms. You know, a lot of researchers want to keep their data and keep their ideas kind of hidden until they're ready to publish in a high impact journal. And so that was a bit of a barrier to open sharing. And then finally, infrastructure. Pharmaceuticals take a lot of infrastructure to navigate regulations and make safe drugs, which is important. And so the citizen science group, the open insulin group, really struggled with that infrastructure. And so those were some of the key barriers that I found. And then finally, I'll just conclude with my research uncovered a wide range of open science, the ways that open science is being applied to drug research and development and why. For some, openness meant to totally reimagine how medicines are made available to people, right? That was the vision of the citizen science group. Then there were these larger initiatives and other actors who were trying to figure out a better way to leverage research to address economically neglected diseases. So for these folks, this meant shifting the political economy of pharmaceuticals a little bit but otherwise keeping things pretty much in the system. I'll note that no drug has been made yet through these open science efforts, so it's hard to comment on their impact on equity. But I do think that some of these larger coalitions are making inroads to reimagine more equitable approaches to drug development and open science through open science. And up next, our next presenter will be Mel Jeske, presenting from University of Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation to share my work with you tonight. My name is Melanie Jeske, and I'm currently a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Chicago at the Institute on the Formation of Knowledge. My research agenda falls in three areas that are really at the intersection of medical sociology and a field called science and technology studies. I examine the production of biomedical knowledge and technologies, which is a project that I'll be talking about tonight, as well as scientific organizations and cultures. I'll also talk about a second project in that area, and the unequal experiences of chronic illness. Fundamentally, I'm interested in excavating how biomedical knowledge and novel technologies are profoundly consequential for the public, shaping how we, as everyday people, understand the human condition and social difference, and how we experience and navigate health and illness. I take science, medicine, and technology to be profoundly social endeavors and rich sites for sociologists like myself to investigate social practices, values, and power structures. And while these are discrete areas of my research, they overlap in important ways that are really indicative of the social nature of health and biomedicine. Central to my research is the notion that the knowledge we produce and the technologies we make cannot be separated from the values invested in them, the labor and institutions through which they are produced, and the bodies they are used to render knowable. As I move my work forward, I'm always thinking about how we investigate these intersections and questions and how to gather the kinds of empirical data we need to answer them. My work largely relies on qualitative data, utilizing in-depth interviews with scientists and researchers, as well as people who experience chronic illnesses and utilize the technologies being developed in laboratories, as well as observations, conducting ethnography in laboratories, as well as clinical encounters. Today, I'm going to talk about two areas of my work briefly. The first focused on the development and adoption of novel biomedical technologies called organ chips, and the second focused on scientific labor and addressing inequalities in scientific organizations themselves. My current book project emerged out of my dissertation that I completed at UCSF last year, which examines the emergence of novel biomedical technologies called organ chips and situates the rising prominence of biomedical engineering in medicine. The book is really situated in sociology of science and medicine, as well as economic sociology, and it's about how scientific organizations work together to bring novel technologies into fruition and ensure that they fit within existing infrastructures, that is, the systems that largely determine whether a new technology can and will be successful. The book is an ethnographic project and draws on years of fieldwork and interviews with researchers developing these technologies. So, what are organ chips? Organ chips are quite new innovations, and many of you may have never heard of them or are just beginning to. They are microfluidic technologies that model human organs, and they are tools that are used in the most basic stages of biomedical research. Critically, they are in vitro experimental models of the body, and so these are not implants, these are not chips that would be inserted into the body in any way. They are simply models of human organs used for biomedical research and drug discovery. They are typically clear polymers about the size of a flash drive, with channels and reservoirs etched into them, designed to model a particular organ. Adult stem cells, primary patient cells, or commercially available cells provide the specialized cells of interest. And the models also mimic the mechanical function of organs where relevant. And this is important to note that they're really modeling those sort of minimal functioning units of particular organs. But a heart chip is made to beat, an eye blinks, a lung breathes. Importantly, these models use human cells in stages of research where this has not been previously been possible, introducing them to replace non-human animal models, which have high rates of failure when moving from non-human to human studies for pharmaceuticals. Indeed, research suggests that almost 90% of research that is done in non-human animal models shown to be safe and effective in mice turn out not to be safe and effective in humans. And organ chips intervene at this critical juncture, introducing human cells into that early stage of research for better predictive capacity. Chemical compounds and pathogens can then be administered using these technologies to gauge the reaction of human cells, offering insight into predicted human response. For instance, how will a human respond to a given pharmaceutical? How will lungs react to the introduction of a virus? On the center image here, you see the various organ systems that organ chips have been made for initially when the NCATS, the NIH National Center for Advancing the Translational Sciences, launched its tissue chip program in 2012. Right and left of the center image, you see a few different organs. On the top right is the kidney chip, and you see a dime next to it, just to give you a sense of how small these actually are. On the bottom right is an eye chip. That blue plastic disc slides over the eye, lined with eyelid cells in order to mimic the blinking of an eye. As I mentioned, these are novel technologies. In 2010, a team of researchers published a paper in Science claiming to have reconstituted organ-level function on a chip platform. They claimed this technology provided a more accurate way to model the human body and its responses than animals, like mice, rabbits, hamsters, and dogs, which have been integral to biomedical research in the last century, because it used human cells. They posited that these technologies could one day replace animal models in pharmaceutical and toxicity research. You see here on the slide a snapshot of this first peer-reviewed article documenting the development of this technology. Soon after, a heart chip was developed by researchers at the same institute, the Beetz Institute at Harvard. Less than 2 years later, the National Institutes of Health and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency committed substantial federal funding toward the development of 10 organ chip platforms, those that are listed on the left here, as well as two integrative human on a chip platforms. Since then, research in this area and public and private investment in these technologies has greatly expanded. Rather quickly, organ chips became touted as the future of biomedicine, and they were featured in 2016 as one of World Economic Forum's most promising emerging technologies, alongside autonomous vehicles and blockchain. And as far-fetched as these devices may seem, they are increasingly being used in biomedical contexts. Moreover, recently passed critical legislation clears the final hurdle for these technologies to become even more ubiquitous. At the close of 2022, the FDA Modernization Act 2.0 was passed with bipartisan support. This legislation makes a critical change to the pharmaceutical regulatory infrastructure. Experimental drugs no longer have to be tested on non-human animal models before human clinical trials can be approved. This changes longstanding regulation that has necessitated the use of non-human animal studies in the development of pharmaceuticals. Now, of course, I must note that such legislation does not change the longstanding norms and practices of scientific work, and this is an issue that I take up extensively in the book. But I became curious as a sociologist as to what accounts for the rapid ascent, swift uptake, and investment in these technologies. How do organ chips come to be seen as the right technology to tackle particular problems? Why were people galvanizing around these technologies in such a way? And what makes these models better than existing methods? What's so promising about them? While dominant narratives of novel technology and society paint a picture of linear progress and technological inevitability in many ways, as a sociologist, I see this conclusion as anything but inevitable. Instead, as sociologists, we often understand technological adoption to be the result of specific social action and decision-making processes, and critically, about the stories that are told about innovation, the hyping work and narrative construction requisite to bringing them to life. And so my book project examines these processes, tracing organ chip development from its earliest days, the organizations and scientists involved, through to the very construction of these technologies and how claims are made about what they model and the values that shape their design. I want to turn now briefly to a second project that I hope will be of interest to you all. The second line of my work that I'd like to talk about briefly really emerged from my fieldwork in laboratories. When the pandemic hit in 2020, I was conducting fieldwork for my dissertation research, and it became very clear how stressful this time was for all of us, but also for laboratory workers. And so I really pivoted to capture these experiences and to better understand not only the disruptions and stressors that the pandemic exacerbated, but also the power dynamics in scientific work more generally that have long been at play, but became acutely visible during this time. In the wake of 2020, many scientists and researchers who often talked about science being separate from the social world and politics began to understand how their work was deeply implicated in the everyday inequality and racism that was playing out on the national stage. As an ethnographer in these spaces, many of my research participants began talking about these issues more openly with me. In interviews for my COVID study that you see a paper from on the left, my participants often brought up how the racial injustices and protests happening across the country led them to reflect about what they can do in their own work settings to bring about change. They wanted to engage their lab groups about racism in science and medicine, but didn't necessarily feel like they had the tools to do so. Many talked about momentum following shutdown academia and shutdown STEM efforts, but that over time, their laboratories failed to sustain engagement on these issues. This made me consider how we keep these conversations going, how we hold one another accountable, and how social scientists like myself, who are deeply trained in and interested in these topics, can work together with STEM researchers to create tools. As I'm sure many of you may be aware, in the 3 years since the pandemic began, and also in the years before, there have been many discussions of burnout in academic science, STEM graduates opting out of academic career tracks, and the structural exclusions of scientists and researchers of color. My work in this area is deeply concerned with these issues, and particularly how the structural conditions of academic research, including the precarity of postdoctoral scholars and doctoral education in STEM fields, and the declining security of faculty positions, work in opposition of goals of diversity and inclusion. Bringing my sociological toolkit to this space and expertise conducting research, I designed an intervention project with a colleague at UCSF, Jason Garcia, who is in the TETRAD program. Jason and I took a diversity, equity, and inclusion leadership course in the fall of 2020, taught by the great Deanne Duncan, and we decided to team up to develop what we call the DeSilo Project. DeSilo stands for Diversity, Equity, and Sociology Training in Laboratory Organizations. Our name, DeSilo, is inspired by the silos and boundaries that keep us from reckoning with the ways in which science and society are inseparable. In this project, we really grapple with these silos, recognizing their existence and questioning their purpose and utility, and collectively working to dismantle them. In the 2021-2022 year, working with junior researchers, two postdocs, two grad students at labs throughout the country, R1 research intensive institutions, we launched this program, which offers a curriculum of sorts, including discussion facilitation guides and resources for labs who are trying to make meaningful diversity and equity inclusion efforts in their labs happen. We felt we were at this pivotal juncture to really make sure that the efforts we saw in academic science in 2020, as well as the sort of explosion of diversity and inclusion statements, which can often seem performative, did not fade, but instead became part of the fabric of a different kind of way to do science. Much sociological scholarship and my work in this area as well shows that many diversity and inclusion efforts are not only performative, but that when they are surface level interventions, they actually stand to deepen inequality. And so we wanted to figure out how we could envision practices, ones that are routine and frequent, that would help to create more inclusive lab environments. DeSilo is really about integrating those kinds of practices into the culture of labs. And we thought one way to do this would be to make it a portion of lab meetings, a routine feature of every lab, usually a weekly meeting, that happens on some sort of time interval. So perhaps every month or so, or every other month, where one of the modules from DeSilo would be implemented. The project really brings STS sensibilities and concepts from sociology into the laboratory environment in an effort to make small but durable changes. We're focused on micro-level interactions, important interactions, because this is where daily life in science takes place and shapes the experience of trainees. And so while institutional policies and programs, which are more at the meso level in sociology speak, are extremely important, so too are these sort of more micro group level interactions. In our pilot year, we learned a lot about what does and doesn't work around labor sharing, PI involvement, and burnout. And we are currently working on publishing the findings from this study. It's something that we hope to continue in partnership with labs for a longitudinal intervention and study, as well as a structural intervention on the persistent diversity and equity issues in academic science. And with that, I'll end. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here to talk about my my dissertation research. So I will dive in. My research bridges clinical knowledge and social science, and it overarchingly focuses on the social experiences of health and illness. I study how stigma operates in the context of health and contributes to medicalization. And I'm motivated by a commitment to health justice, which to me means liberation from biomedical dominance, pursuing health equity across communities, and cultivating humane working conditions for healthcare professionals. The research I'm presenting on today comes from my dissertation, which takes a sociological approach to understanding the emerging practice of integrating mental health into perinatal healthcare, especially obstetric settings. I wanted to understand how patients experienced mental health screening in their perinatal care, how midwives and obstetricians addressed the mental health needs of their patients, and what happened when mental health clinicians were brought into obstetric settings to provide specialty mental health care. Before we dig into this further, I want to tell you about the intersecting problems that make this an important issue to understand and an interesting empirical site for sociological investigation. So my research sits at the intersection of these three big problems in health and healthcare in the United States. First, we're increasingly aware of the myriad mental health crises among us, made especially more visible in the wake of the COVID-19 era. We're seeing worsening health outcomes and inequities for pregnant and postpartum people. And healthcare in the United States, again, especially visible in the wake of COVID-19, is broadly in crisis with worker shortages, high burnout among health professionals, high cost but low access, and growing inequities in access to and quality of care. Of particular relevance to my research is the fact that mental health conditions are one of the leading causes of pregnancy-related death and illness in the United States, and they're referred to as the most common complication of childbirth. Roughly a quarter of birthing people will develop perinatal depression or anxiety. Rates of suicidal ideation, which is one marker of deteriorating mental health, have tripled among birthing people in the past 15 years. And birthing people are more likely to complete suicide in the year following childbirth than any other time of life. It's universally true that pregnancy and childbirth are more than physical processes, environment, social structures, relationships, emotions, psychological factors, all of which constitute mental health, are part of the perinatal experience. Early parenthood commonly includes an increase in social stressors, plus a wide range of emotional experiences and identity transitions. Research about perinatal mental health has identified that stressful life events, low social support, and socioeconomic strain all have bearing on mental health. Despite the prevalence of perinatal mental health issues, the predominant obstetric model of how we take care of people through pregnancy in the United States doesn't reflect this multidimensionality of pregnancy and postpartum health. Routine obstetric care is based on highest risk metrics and prioritizes physical health markers and fetal monitoring in its standards of care. Perinatal health care spending is high in the U.S., amounting to over $100 billion annually, yet pregnancy-related mortality increased by 136% between 1990 and 2013. Inequities in perinatal health and healthcare are astounding. High poverty states have a 77% higher mortality rate than wealthier states, and the mortality rate among Black birthing people in the U.S. is profoundly high. Other perinatal health outcomes are also poor and stratified, negatively impacted by a homogenous healthcare workforce, institutionalized racism and misogyny, and poverty. So this paints a picture of perinatal healthcare in the U.S. as a high-cost, poor outcomes system that is plagued by pervasive structural problems, and it puts into question the efficacy of the prevailing approach to pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum. Nevertheless, biomedicine continues to inform most of the current efforts to address the perinatal health crises, including mental health. Given biomedical dominance in perinatal care in the U.S., perinatal mental health advocates tend to emphasize the importance of integrating mental health screening and treatment in obstetrics, and legislative trends are increasing state requirements that perinatal clinicians administer mental health screening of their patients across the U.S. So on its face, this is a reasonable and well-intended idea. However, there are some concerns about standardized mental health screening in obstetrics, such as limited access to mental health care, stigma that acts as a barrier to screening and treatment, and a persistent mind-body binary in biomedicine that leaves clinicians feeling underprepared to address patients' mental health. So bringing mental health into the realm of perinatal care has, on the one hand, the possibility of elevating mental health as an important aspect of the perinatal period. But on the other hand, known problems with standardized mental health screening, health inequities that are potentially worsened by medical oversight, the marginalized status of mental health, all suggest challenges in the process of expanding biomedical obstetrics to encompass mental health. So this puzzle really motivated my research, and my work addresses these tensions. Really briefly, I conducted in-depth interviews and ethnographic observations for this research. And I'm going to give you a brief overview of each, I hope, if I have time, each of the three empirical chapters in my dissertation. I'll probably do a slightly deeper dive on chapter two, this first one. So as the front line of perinatal healthcare, nurse midwives and obstetricians are tasked with responding to the standardization of mental health screening in obstetric settings. All seven of the healthcare organizations represented in this study had formalized at least one element of perinatal mental health screening, which was usually administering the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale at least one time during routine prenatal or postpartum care. Efforts to implement and comply with this newly standardized practice generated a lot of discomfort among the obstetric clinicians in this study, many of whom felt ill-equipped to deal with mental health issues. They encountered a tension between an emerging approach to care to include mental health and multiple forces impeding their efforts toward mental health inclusive care. They told me things like, it's one of those Pandora's box things. When you bring it up, you have to be able to follow through, and I can't do that adequately. Or I honestly feel helpless. I'm seeing someone in front of me who's saying, I need support. I have 15 minutes. I can't be that person right now. So clinicians were concerned that given the few minutes they're typically allotted for each patient visit, they would need to interrupt a distressed patient and leave abruptly without closure or a satisfactory care plan. So uniformly, clinicians articulated that this challenge of time deficit is coupled with being, in their words, clearly underprepared by training, leaving them without strategies to practically meet the mental health needs of their patients. So I found in the end that obstetric clinicians were afraid of serious mental health issues that they might miss, in addition to the sense of helplessness they felt when they identified a patient's mental health needs. So there was this sort of dual conflicting fears, on the one hand, failing to identify significant mental health issues, and then on the other hand, identifying a mental health issue, but not knowing where to go from there. So integrating behavioral health teams in obstetric settings was seen as a logical solution to this quandary. To give you a sense of what this looked like, the mental health teams in each of these organizations were made up of clinical social workers, professional counselors, psychologists, and psychiatric nurse practitioners. There was about one mental health clinician for every 10 to 20 obstetric clinicians, depending on the organization. And their approach to patient care varied by organization and changed over time, but most of them attempted to provide a therapy model of frequent hour-long appointments until they ultimately had to adjust due to patient volume. Having these co-located mental health clinicians brought obstetric clinicians relief from their sense of helplessness, and they tended to lean very heavily on their mental health colleagues, which quickly led to an overwhelming amount of work for the behavioral health teams. So early in my fieldwork and prior to COVID-19, I learned that the behavioral health team at one of my research sites received approximately 30 referrals from obstetric clinicians per day, and they maintained a wait list of nearly 80 people. The mental health clinicians were routinely pulled into exam rooms, and these, what they called warm handoffs, served to increase the likelihood that obstetric patients would follow through with a mental health referral. But mainly that practice brought obstetric clinicians a lot of comfort as they're seeking resolution to a patient's problem. So in turn, mental health clinicians felt a lot of pressure to respond to every referral and warm handoff. Some told me they felt they had to be in a yes place all the time. And so their experience really reflects the hierarchical and fast-paced nature of the biomedical settings. So since the obstetric clinicians originate every behavioral health referral, discretionary power over identifying who needs mental health care lies with them and places the onus on mental health clinicians to respond to each referral. This unidirectionality, especially in a setting where biomedical knowledge is dominant, positioned mental health clinicians as in service to their obstetric colleagues. Mental health clinicians are outsiders in biomedical settings, and their services are poorly compensated by insurance companies, which really limits their power. So many mental health clinicians struggled with ethics of care, worrying that efforts to meet demand came at the cost of diminished quality of care. They reported that patients frequently waited 4 to 6 weeks between appointments when their standard of care is to see most patients on a weekly or biweekly basis. So, you know, in sort of summary, co-locating mental health care in this way is really trying to compensate for the failures of a system that is in deficit from all angles, and clinicians are trying to navigate their fluctuating roles at the front line of this effort. So given these challenges for the behavioral health teams, I found that they deployed two primary strategies to navigate high patient volume and manage their position in the hierarchy of obstetrics. The first strategy was that they took on an educator role with their obstetric colleagues in an effort to make mental health normal in the context of the perinatal period. So the mental health clinicians argued that because emotional and mental health issues are an expected part of perinatal experience, then obstetric clinicians have a responsibility to address their patients' mental health in some capacity beyond just screening. The second strategy was leaning into standardized care logics, and they developed a standardized referral protocol that had quite strict criteria for patients who would be accepted for mental health care. So this was a big pivot away from the norm of saying yes to referrals. The behavioral health director at one point told their new referral manager, when in doubt, say no. So it was a big change for the team. It made a big impact. And in a stretch of 5 days, the referral manager triaged 120 referrals, and only 5 of those met their new referral threshold. So the behavioral health team's new boundaries to manage their work in this setting accomplished 3 key things. First, it reinforced their message to their OB colleagues that they had some responsibility to address the commonplace emotional and mental realm of the perinatal period. It gave them an opportunity to claim and demonstrate their expertise, and they asserted authority by operationalizing a referral protocol in a standardized way that required their colleagues' adherence. So the behavioral health team strategies, all in the end, reduced the referrals they received and allowed them to implement a more sustainable model of mental health care and obstetrics. However, it was ultimately a less integrated model of care. And this siloing, I argue, is an inevitable consequence of the hierarchical organization of healthcare. And it was necessary to sustain mental health clinicians' work in this high volume setting. Really quickly, I'm just going to breeze through the next couple of chapters, and I'm happy to revisit some of these details in the question and answer session. Whole person health is an intervention that's meant to correct biomedicine's history of separating disease from the person. So one relevant piece is that it importantly focuses on the patient-clinician relationship and collaboration across healthcare teams. So in this chapter, I argue that whole person health approaches to care to a degree are already interventions for pregnant and postpartum people's mental health, and they can importantly shift us away from a disease-oriented model of perinatal care. And then in chapter 4, I argue that obstetrics is a primary social influence of people's pregnancy experiences, and it contributes to the high occurrence of perinatal stress and anxiety because of the high risk categories that organize, that are institutionalized and organize obstetric care. Because of this sort of negative impact that obstetric care itself has on people's mental well-being, I argue that it's difficult to make substantial gains toward improved mental health for pregnant and postpartum people in the United States. So my research shows that merely integrating behavioral health teams into the current system of care is not a sustainable or far-reaching solution to address the predominance of mental health issues in pregnancy and postpartum. These interventions nudge incremental change toward the expansion of mental health care for people in the perinatal period, but without policy change and a restructuring of perinatal health care wholesale, mental health clinicians will continue to have limited impact. So my research offers insights for health and social policy and healthcare that both improves biomedicine and looks beyond it for opportunities to better address perinatal mental health. So as I close, I just want to emphasize that clinicians, all of the clinicians I had the privilege of studying, researching, being with through my dissertation work, my field work, They really are doing their best to provide care with the resources they have at hand. Through my ethnographic fieldwork with a behavioral health team in particular, I got to see multiple iterations of their attempts to integrate mental and perinatal health care, plus many of its growing pains, particularly given the immediacy of the COVID-19 pandemic. Developing new models of perinatal healthcare and improving perinatal mental health outcomes are complicated endeavors. Because people's mental health is significantly impacted through pregnancy and postpartum and bears on the whole family, it makes sense to elevate this as cause for concern. And yet, successfully addressing perinatal mental health is hamstrung by myriad structural barriers and biomedical dominance. So it's my goal, ultimately, that we better understand the perinatal healthcare landscape and work to make it mental health inclusive. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Harrison. Good evening, everyone. Before I offer some concluding remarks, I want to again thank our wonderful presenters and audience members for your curiosity and interest in learning more about how sociology enriches the health sciences campus. I'd also like to reiterate my thanks to the event's organizers and to my colleague, Dr. Kristen Harknett, for setting the stage for tonight's program. The three studies we have learned about today offer a crucial glimpse into different social worlds at the forefront of healthcare and technology development, of open science and community biology in Dr. Foti's research on open pharma and lay participation in drug research, of the dynamics of mental health integration in perinatal and postpartum healthcare settings in Dr. Harrison's research on the ongoing challenges that pregnant people face in obtaining life-saving care, and of emergent technology in the making in Dr. Jeske's research on organ chips. As disparate as these worlds may appear, I would like to highlight a few themes that unite our presenters' unique contributions to our growing body of medical sociology knowledge. All three skillfully use qualitative research methodology, often drawing on multiple methods such as in-depth interviews, ethnographic observations, and content analysis. Such social science lenses have allowed these researchers to gain multiple view angles. They demonstrate the power of being there. Observing people's interactions over time helps make visible the dynamics of unfolding social processes that highlight different challenges, hurdles, opportunities, and people's participation, agency, and resistance in situations that often require flexibility to navigate and surmount. In different ways, tonight's presenters have managed to capture their research participants' lived experiences of the social phenomena under examination. Their studies emphasize the great potential of social science research for exploration, discovery, and challenging conventional wisdom by uncovering the interactional dynamics embedded in organizations and institutions. In zooming out to understand the bigger picture contributions of social science to a medical sciences campus, to clinical practice, and to health policy, the research of Drs. Foti, Harrison, and Jeske, and those following in their footsteps, provide key data and research tools to advance the goals of health equity, and thus they further a mission that many of us at UCSF are committed to working towards, whatever our positionality, research foci, and prior education and training.
I'm going to start with what I think are a few questions. Nicole, I'll start with you. One of the things that stood out for me, by the way, fantastic conversations here. I'm like, I got so many questions. So you talked about negative results and how open source is using negative data in order to be innovative, I suppose. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure, yes. I know I breezed by the negative findings portion, but one of the motivators for open science and pharma has been well, what happens in research, and let me back up for a moment. What happens in scientific research is, you know, you do your experiments. It's very, it can be very tedious, and there's a lot of findings that don't really go anywhere, right? You have to make sure that you're finding the right path, and you find a lot of dead ends in the meantime, all along the way, I should say. And so those are what some people refer to as negative findings. And so those would be, you know, you still have a piece of knowledge, or you still found that that isn't the path that you should continue down. And but within our current scientific structure ecosystem, those tend not to get published, right? That what gets published in high impact journals or any journals is the what did we find, what worked. And so these negative findings kind of are like, you know, researchers know that didn't work, but they're not sharing that knowledge. And so what happens is research gets duplicated unnecessarily because they don't know that another research team already did that experiment. And they already know that that's not going to lead to a fruitful next step, you know, eventually to a therapeutic per se. So open science, one of the interventions, one way of using it would be to say, okay, we place all of the scientific findings, including negative findings, including things that didn't work, into the public domain so that other scientists around the world can say, oh, that's already been done. I don't need to use my resources, my grant or my university's resources or federal funding to explore that. We know that it, you know, someone already explored that. And so we can at least potentially help make more efficient research by doing so. So hopefully that answered your question.
Makes perfect sense to me. Thank you. You did a lovely job of explaining this interplay between mental behavioral health and OB clinicians. And you defined the problem really well. So now I'm like, okay, what's the answer? Right. So what policies would you change or would that what policy changes need to be made across the ecosystem in order to solve the issue, right? Because one of the things I keep thinking about is mental health crisis is increasing more and more, right? We see that all along the academic arc, and we can't train people fast enough even to do the limited model that you're suggesting here. So what is the solution?
Well, sociologists are notorious for excavating problems and not solving them. So I can't really claim to have great answers, but I have ideas. And these are not just my ideas. They're drawn from a lot of people doing this work, including Dr. Harknett. One of the big things is high-level health and social policy that would improve living conditions, right? So addressing poverty, chronic poverty has huge bearing on mental health, unstable work schedules, no access to childcare, paid family leave. We don't have any paid family leave at a federal level in this country, and that's a really big problem. So those are, you know, way upstream ideas that we can, you know, see how they bear on holistic health outcomes. So that's maybe the macro level. More at the meso level, in thinking about the organization of healthcare, I think drawing on community-based models of postpartum healthcare in particular, which is the highest risk period for people in all corners of health. We don't have great models aside from community midwifery in the United States, which is serving such a small percentage of people. So building out community midwifery, they have a great postpartum care model, trying to build out community mental health, right? Like you're saying, and then elevating midwifery itself. Nurse midwives are embedded in obstetric settings. They can practice in every state in the country, but they still are the minority in providing care. Their model of care tends to approach sort of the whole person, as I briefly mentioned in my talk. So elevating them as the primary approach to perinatal health care, reconsidering, you know, what obstetricians are trained to do, how can they be supportive within their sort of scope and have midwives managing a lot of the care. And then I think there are things that can happen in clinical practice, right? I think knowing that attentive communication can make a difference, right? That being just being a presence and asking a question, right? I know that time is such a barrier, so it's difficult even for clinicians to think about doing that. But the smallest of gestures can have a positive impact on how a person feels in the clinical encounter. And I think, too, one of the big things for mental health clinicians who are integrating in biomedical spaces, I think trying to find ways to resist acculturation in the medical model and try to stay as sort of true to their clinical judgment and, you know, practice ethics and ethos, I think is important. So I'll leave it at that.
So let me just follow up on that really briefly. So is it your experience and or opinion that elevating the role of midwives in prenatal care or perinatal care, sorry, is it your opinion that the OBs will buy into that?
That's one of the big dilemmas in the United States. It's complicated because the insurance companies are a huge player here. And I cannot claim to be an expert on all of the ins and outs of the quagmire of you know, the many payer system that we have. But there's also this piece of biomedical dominance that I talk about and some claiming of the work, right? And we also as a culture have bought into this in the United States as a society. We have decided that pregnancy is extremely risky and that obstetricians are the ones who are, you know, best suited to manage risk. And I think rethinking that, right, really, you know, critically engaging with what is risk and how do we measure risk? And, you know, when we're seeing that mental health issues are really one of the prominent risks, threats to health in this period, but, you know, it's being ignored essentially in a lot of spaces, you know, maybe we're a bit off in how we think about risk. And so I don't know if I think it is a hard sell in the United States.
I was looking at the news. I think it was the news. I don't quite remember. And it highlighted the role of midwives in birth survivals of Black women. Mm-hmm. And the indication is sort of what you're hinting at in your conversation here, that it is a different level of care that allows the midwife. First of all, many of the midwives were Black, and therefore there was this identity. But child mortality for Black women is much, much higher than the rest of the population. And this small study somewhere, I don't even remember where, was highlighting the role of midwives. But I also understand the economics of that.
Yeah.
All right. Nicole, so your very first slide, you showed this fairly dramatic rise in drug prices for all four of the popular versions of insulin. And I think that the statement you made was that there are three things that are impacting how biotech companies sort of survive, right? The declining drug innovation ecosystem, the neglected disease are reasons for open, what is it? Open insulin.
Open pharma.
Right, yeah. Neglected diseases. And then the third one was, what was the third one?
Access to medicines and affordability.
There you go. So, When drug prices go from somewhere less than $50 to somewhere over $250, if I was reading that slide correctly, any indication of how that actually impacted users over that time period?
Sure. So I think maybe embedded in your question is how many patients really paid that $250 cost, right? We were in a, as Jessica or Dr. Harrison was just noting, we're in a quagmire of a, you know, a very piecemeal health insurance system. And so, but of course, many people have insurance. And so they were not paying necessarily the $250. But I can break down a couple of things. So about a fourth of people who use insulin, usually people with diabetes, use insulin. They ration their insulin. That was a study that came out in the last few years. Also about 10% of people in the US, I think it varies a little bit, but around 10% don't have insurance in the US. So they would be paying that full cost. And I think even more so, so I used to work in social work at a nonprofit, actually working with people and helping them access medicines, people living with HIV. And so I actually had a pretty intimate view of low-income folks who are navigating, you know, sometimes being on public health insurance, Medicaid or Medicare, and then maybe they get a job and they get a little bit of private insurance and then their job switches. And so I think this 10% of people who aren't insured, it doesn't really capture how many people suddenly lose their insurance for a month or 2 months, and they go from paying, you know, $30 for insulin or $50 for insulin with their insurance to $250 just for one vial. A lot of people who use insulin require multiple vials. They'll use slow-acting insulin as well as fast-acting. So, you know, there were reports of people spending thousands of dollars, and that's often some of the more notable cases of, or the cases that reach the mainstream news of people who passed away from not being able to afford their insulin, usually were like younger people who had just lost their insurance, or others who were navigating this piecemeal system and then suddenly can't afford $2,000 for their insulin. So, so of course, not everyone was paying $250 or more, but a portion of people are constantly at risk of losing their insurance or don't have insurance and at risk of spending whatever it takes to get the medicines that they need to survive.
So on some level, it's our insurance that is sometimes the barrier, right? Because the drug companies won't increase their prices if the insurance doesn't also increase their coverage. Is that a fair statement?
Well, for insulin, they were also increasing the amount of like the out-of-pocket costs for people with insurance as well. Not as substantially, but there were reports of people with insurance also being impacted by this more general price increase.
I'm going to switch topics a little bit and talk about why you chose UCSF sociology program, and also what was your, so two questions, why did you choose UCSF and what's been your best experience in the program?
I had these topical interests that were looking at the social, cultural, and political nature of biomedicine. I had an interest in access to medicines and sociology. The sociology program at UCSF is known for having, you know, amazing set of faculty who are looking at those kinds of problems. Excellent record of producing, you know, of having a wonderful intellectual community in which I could help develop myself as a researcher and actually study these kinds of things in a rigorous way. And so that was really my motivation for coming to UCSF. My best experience at UCSF, I mean, I will have to say that I was one of the students who, well, you know, was here during the pandemic. So was kind of a, few years of intensity as we all experienced and hardship. But I would say my best experience was, it's a really supportive program. And I've heard that's not the case for all departments and all programs. And so I really felt like I had collaborators, not competitors, to have dialogue with and to communicate and to support each other over, what's a difficult training generally, and then a particularly difficult training under the pandemic. And so I think that was my best experience, is the people who are at UCSF in the sociology program and beyond in the graduate division and elsewhere in the university.
Excellent. Jessica?
Yeah, I will echo all of that and say that this is where a person wants to be if you are interested in the social world of health and medicine. I mean, this is really just such an excellent place for that inquiry. And I will add that I don't know of another sociology PhD program in the United States that requires a series of qualitative methodology training. And that really sets our department apart, that we have parity in a required curriculum for quantitative and qualitative methodologies. Most, if not all, I might even say all, have a requirement of quantitative methodology training with electives of qualitative methods. The rigor and the honoring of qualitative methodology as a legitimate approach to scientific inquiry was really meaningful to me and one of the primary reasons I chose it. And for me, my advisor, Janet Shim, and my cohort I just feel so immensely fortunate that I have been surrounded by this incredible group of people. So that's been the best part of my experience, for sure.
Excellent. Good to hear. Thank you all, including Kristen and Stacey. Thank you all for the wonderful presentation. I learned a lot, even as dean. Very intriguing work that you are doing, and we are certainly going to make full use of our social scientists on campus in the coming years. But thank you all for your presentation tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.